Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Lawrence Whitner, professor of history emeritus at the State University of New York, who discusses Donald Trump's reckless infatuation with nuclear weapons and the danger posed to the world should he win re-election. Andrew Watkins, a New York Times best-selling author who examines the links between the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, Donald Trump, and extremist Christian nationalist theology. And Alex Chatfield of the Coalition to Stop Private Jet Expansion at Hascom or Anywhere, who talks about his group's campaign to stop the expansion of a climate-polluting private jet facility at a Bedford, Massachusetts airport. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Violent protests rocked Bangladesh's capital, Dhaka, as students mobilized against an employment quota system that reserves jobs for the relatives of veterans from the country's 1971 war for independence against Pakistan. Students are frustrated by the high level of youth unemployment and angry about the nepotism and corruption they see under the rule of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who has been in power 15 years. The bloody riots, which killed nearly 200 people, began after the Bangladeshi Supreme Court reintroduced a job quota system abolished in 2018, which sets aside 30% of public sector jobs for the descendants of war veterans. But after a week of protests, the High Court decreased the job quota to 5% for war veteran descendants and 2% of jobs for ethnic minorities. Student groups are demanding justice for the protesters killed and the release of some 4,000 detained activists. Students blamed security forces for the violence, charging that police responded to their peaceful protests by firing tear gas and rubber bullets. According to Ali Riaz, a politics professor at Illinois State University, today's Bangladeshi student movement now constitutes the most formidable and serious challenge to Sheikh Hasina's rule to date. Rising sea levels along the southern U.S. coast are creating a new set of climate change challenges for many vulnerable communities. Torrential rain and high tide flooding is rivaling hurricane damage over the long term. Climate scientist John Jin-Yin told The Washington Post such flooding is abnormal, unprecedented, and irreversible. Tides from North Carolina to Texas are 6 to 9 inches higher than in 2010 and are overwhelming wetlands, the natural barriers against major storm surges. The Gulf of Mexico has seen rising waters at twice the rate experienced globally. With wetlands in Louisiana literally drowning in seawater, septic systems are failing and contaminating waterways. In some areas, rising waters regularly cut off people from emergency services. Rob Young, director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines based in North Carolina, said, "We are preparing for the wrong disaster almost everywhere. These smaller changes will be a greater threat over time than the next hurricane." 3 years ago, Connecticut State Senator Norm Needleman introduced legislation that would provide incentives to lure large data centers to the state. Connecticut was looking to compete with other states to host massive server farms that service tech giants like Google and Facebook. Today, Needleman is having second thoughts about granting generous tax breaks and energy discounts to data center developers. Particularly concerning to him are plans for a mega data center on the site of the state's only nuclear power plant. The developer is proposing an arrangement that would give the data farm priority access to electricity generated at the plant, which would mean less carbon-free power for other users. The legislator worries that the plan would create additional demand for renewable energy that would have to be replaced to meet the state's climate emissions goals. Other states, including Georgia and South Carolina, are also rethinking the offer of big tax breaks and energy discounts to data centers, which largely fail to produce many permanent jobs. A report by the business consultancy McKinsey & Company found electric demand for data centers will double by the year 2030, enough electricity to power more than 26 million average homes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
This August 6th and 9th, the world will mark the 79th anniversary of the only use of nuclear weapons in war, the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, that ended World War II. Today, the threat of a nuclear conflict looms larger than it has for many years, as Russian President Vladimir Putin threatens the use of tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine, where the U.S. and NATO supply the Kyiv government with an increasing number of high-tech weapon systems. Compounding the threat of the future use of nuclear weapons is the fact that over the past 10 years, most nuclear arms control and disarmament agreements have either been abrogated by the signatories or will soon expire. During Donald Trump's 4 years as president, he unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 International Nuclear Agreement with Iran. He disavowed the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty and pulled out of the 1992 Open Skies Treaty. Before losing the 2020 U.S. presidential election, Trump had blocked extending the New START Treaty, the last remaining agreement, limiting the U.S. and Russian strategic nuclear arsenals, a policy later reversed by the incoming Biden administration. Your reporter spoke with Lawrence Whitner, professor of history emeritus at the State University of New York at Albany, who discusses his recent article titled "Donald Trump's Reckless Infatuation with Nuclear Weapons and the Danger Posed to the World Should He Win Re-Election This November."
This June, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that given the heightened risk of nuclear annihilation in the world, as he said, quote, humanity is on a knife's edge. And I think he's correct. A new nuclear arms race is underway, and Trump has provided a major spur to that arms race. In December 2016, shortly after his election victory, he proclaimed, "Let it be an arms race. We will outmatch them at every pass." He's boasted about creating a brand new nuclear force, so far ahead of everybody else in nuclear like you've never seen before. And this U.S. nuclear modernization program that is building new nuclear weapons of every kind to replace older generations of nuclear weapons is estimated to cost up to $2 trillion. This is just the start, though. And the U.S. government under Trump was planning to resume nuclear testing, something that had been stopped in 1992, and the U.S. hasn't tested since that time, hasn't spewed out clouds of radioactive fallout into the atmosphere or tested underground. But the Trump administration was actually planning on resumption, and only the fact that the House of Representatives, then under Democratic control, blocked it by blocking funding. Otherwise, this nuclear testing would have resumed. A number of times, Trump, in fact, stated that he was ready for nuclear war. And in fact, he got into a war of words, including nuclear threats with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. In 2017, those denunciations flowing back and forth from both sides nearly led to a nuclear war. A recent biography of Trump's chief of staff, General John Kelly, revealed that Kelly was horrified that things seemed to be moving toward nuclear war and that Trump found this perfectly acceptable. Eventually, Kelly stated that he appealed to Trump's narcissism to head Trump off and said Trump could be the greatest salesman in world history if he could work out some kind of nuclear deal with North Korea. So Trump quickly about-faced, started this love affair with Kim's government, which of course went nowhere, as it turned out, since the North Korean government didn't plan to get rid of nuclear weapons and continued its nuclear testing and nuclear arms buildup. Oh, and then following that, I should just add, Trump got into another exchange of insults with the Iranian government and once more threatened nuclear war. So I think Trump has been exceptionally reckless, and if reelected president, I think we face a very dangerous future.
Professor Wittner, I did want to ask you about nuclear weapons as an issue in this year's presidential election. It seems that we're focused like a laser beam on important domestic issues, immigration, the future of Social Security and Medicare. There's no shortage of important issues that this campaign is focused on. But it seems that the specter of nuclear war and Trump's past statements and actions, which pose a real threat about a nuclear conflict in the future, are not being much discussed by the Democratic Party. What priority do you think the issue of nuclear weapons and the threat of war should play in this this presidential election campaign?
Oh, I think it should be playing a much greater part than it's played so far. Every once in a while, when there's been a particularly reckless figure who actually talks enthusiastically about nuclear war, as Ronald Reagan did, in those new situations, it finally breaks through to popular consciousness and a mass movement develops. And in fact, it's been that mass movement of the past, that mass resistance to nuclear war, has led to the arms control and disarmament treaties of the past, treaties that actually eliminated some 83% of the world's nuclear weapons. But things seem to have gone backward in recent years, and all the nuclear powers are engaged in a new nuclear arms race. And I think that the public should be made more aware of that, and that the Democratic Party certainly should be pointing to that and to the dangerous recklessness of Donald Trump when it comes to nuclear weapons and nuclear war.
That was Lawrence Wittner, professor of history emeritus at the State University of New York at Albany and author of Confronting the Bomb, A Short History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement. Find a link to Professor Wittner's recent article, Donald Trump's Reckless Infatuation with Nuclear Weapons, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent months, Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation's right-wing extremist blueprint for a second Trump presidency, has come under increased scrutiny by presumptive Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris, the media, and voters. Among a long list of highly detailed policy proposals, the plan calls for immediately firing thousands of qualified civil servants and replacing them with Trump loyalists, further abolition of reproductive rights, deploying the National Guard to crack down on protests, using the military for mass deportation of undocumented immigrants, and weaponizing the Department of Justice to prosecute Trump's political opponents and pardoning January 6 insurrectionists. One central feature of Project 2025 that's often overlooked is that this 900-page document is rooted in Christian nationalism, with a clear goal of replacing democracy with an extremist Christian theocracy that would enable people to use their faith to ignore many civil rights, replacing man's law with God's law. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Watkins, a New York Times bestselling author who's devoted many months researching and dissecting Project 2025 on her Substack page, how Project 2025 will ruin your life. Here, Watkins, who was raised in a Christian fundamentalist home, attended a Christian nationalist school, and a church that was one of the founding members of Jerry Falwell Sr.'s Moral Majority, talks about the threat posed by Project 2025 that, despite recent denials, would serve as a blueprint for a second Trump presidency.
Project 2025 starts with four promises to the American people. And the first promise is that the family is the most important thing in American life. But their definition of the family is the traditional heterosexual one man married to one unrelated woman with as many children as God gives them. Christian nationalism is steeped in the view that the Bible is infallible and inerrant, and it is God's perfect law. So all of the people in our government who adhere to Christian nationalism believe that they are called by God to replace any law that violates their interpretation of the Bible or God's law with God's law, which is a form of biblical law, sacred law, Sharia law, however you want to define it. They believe that they are ordained by God to do that. So we have seen red states, Republican states, follow through with that in areas of abortion, in IVF with the ruling in Alabama, in Republican refusal to enshrine the right to contraception as federal law, in attacks on transgender people and same-sex marriage and no-fault divorce. All of these are things that they tie to their interpretation of the Bible, and they believe that they are called by God to make all of us, whether we even believe the Bible or not, live by their interpretation of the Bible as enshrined in our laws at the federal and state level.
Andra, in a recent Trump speech, he told a group of Christian supporters there that if they elect him in 2024, they won't have to vote anymore if he wins the November election. What's the message he's sending there? That he will declare the end of democracy, or is it something less nefarious?
Project 2025 declares the end of democracy, and the Supreme Court already paved the way for that the week of July 4th in their ruling that presidents have limited immunity and can be above the law. They also passed other rulings that week, weakening the power of the federal government, all of which was called for in Project 2025. Project 2025 is not just a policy document. They have a secret tactical document that Kevin Roberts even admitted to a couple of weeks ago. And so we can look at what various red states are doing vis-a-vis these kinds of things, transgender laws, book bans, DEI, anti-DEI, and critical race theory teachings, anti-LGBTQ laws, etc. Of course, abortion bans, to see what is in the tactical document that undergirds Project 2025. So many red states are already living in a version of Project 2025 theocratic America, whether people realize that or not. So it's really important for people to understand that if we do not vote to have democracy in November, we may never get to vote for democracy again. Trump was being honest about that. They intend to establish a theocratic dictatorship, and Project 2025 invests almost all the power of the federal government in the president, who would be a dictator.
That was Andrew Watkins, a New York Times bestselling author whose research Project 2025 and its links to extremist Christian nationalist theology. Find a link to her Substack page how Project 2025 will ruin your life by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. According to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, global air travel and transport is responsible for 3.5% of all drivers of climate change from human activities. Studies have found that per-person emissions on commercial aircraft are not extraordinarily high, but research finds that private jet travel is 10 to 15 times more polluting than commercial airliners, and per-person CO2 emissions are extremely high. A movement to ban the use of private jets has been developing in recent years, led by Extinction Rebellion and other climate activist groups, some of whom have employed nonviolent direct action to block the doors of airports servicing private jet clients. Citizens concerned about this issue in Massachusetts have formed a coalition to cancel a major expansion of a private jet facility at Hanscom Field, a commercial airport in Bedford, Massachusetts. The coalition opposes the plan, which is supported by the Massachusetts Port Authority, or MassPort, which will triple private jet capacity, much of it for luxury trips to resort destinations for the privileged few. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alex Chatfield, a member of the Coalition to Stop Private Jet Expansion at Hanscom or Anywhere, who talks about their campaign and the movement to ban private jets.
The project was a massive expansion of private jet hangars. And when we found out the size of it, it was shocking. They were proposing to build 27 new hangars, 500,000 square feet of hangar space, enough parking for 70 or 80 private jets, depending on the size. This caused a remarkable coming together of climate activists and other environmental groups, mostly in Eastern Mass. By May, we had sort of formally started a coalition of groups to oppose the project, to do all the advocacy necessary to try to get it canceled. And we've been working on that really for the last 16 months.
So what are the approvals that are needed and what level of government or what bodies have to approve this development?
This is kind of an unusual situation because it's about aviation. Aviation is, it's like a world unto itself, and there are very few direct mechanisms that any other branches of government or any other regulatory bodies can really intervene. The main process that's been playing out is under a law called the Massachusetts Environmental Policy Act, MEPA for short. MassPort is doing this on their own authority. I guess the only counterbalance to that is that there is an environmental review process, but they don't have to seek outside permits in order to actually do this.
Have you made any progress, or are you optimistic about being able to stop this?
We have made a lot of progress. Probably the most significant win we've had so far is that the draft environmental impact report that they made public in the third week of March was soundly rejected by the Mass Environmental Policy Act office and our Secretary of Energy and Environment, Rebecca Tepper. They took public comments from March 22nd to June 14th, and our coalition generated 1,500 public comments, and virtually all of them were in opposition to the project. We also commissioned an independent study by aviation experts challenging some of the data that they were using to justify the project. I think it's fair to say that they really failed in that first round of environmental reporting. And so now they have to go back to the drawing board and write an entirely new, they call it a supplemental environmental impact report, because the first one was considered to be inadequate and insufficient. So that was a win. We've also galvanized lots and lots of political opposition at the municipal level. We now have 14 towns whose elected leaders have signed onto resolutions addressed to the governor and the executive branch, asking that the project be canceled. We have many state legislators who have publicly declared their opposition and written letters to that effect. We've also generated hundreds of people to come out for public protests and civil disobedience actions. So in that respect, I think we have really gotten this onto the public radar. And whoever has found out about it, who cares about climate change, is absolutely opposed and making their views known. Private jets, really almost a symbol of everything that is wrong in our society right now in terms of inequality of wealth and the richest people burning up everyone else's carbon budgets, et cetera. And so that's one of the ironies, is that we have this very rich, powerful state agency that is doubling and tripling down on the private jet industry and catering to the super rich travelers that use jets, at a time when we're in a climate emergency and we expect our government agencies to be aligning themselves with policies that are designed to reduce emissions, not make them much worse.
That was Alex Chatfield, a member of the Coalition to Stop Private Jet Expansion at Hanscom or Anywhere. Learn more about their campaign and others to ban the use of private jets by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, KMWV in Salem, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.